Okay, we resume our meeting for welcome to the FESB staff for an education session on leases, and I believe it's Danielle who's going to tee us up.
Okay, great. Thank you. Good afternoon. Today's education session is to discuss Agenda Paper 12C, FASB Memo 256, regarding transition. This topic will be discussed by both the FASB and the IASB at tomorrow's joint meeting. Several external review comments requested that the board provide additional guidance within the leases revised exposure draft about the tentative decision regarding the transition of leases that are currently classified as capital or finance leases under IAS 17 and Topic 840. As the staff reviewed the board's tentative decisions, the staff considered several ways that we could transition the current capital and finance leases to provide some clarity around what the day two accounting would be. And so in this paper, we've described views A, B, and C to help give some clarity to the exposure draft about what you would do on day two for the transitioning of these current capital and finance leases. And so we wanted to see if the board had any questions on the different views or the paper so that we can hopefully get a joint decision at tomorrow's meeting. So I will turn it over to you to have any questions or questions on the paper.
What is your recommendation?
I think when we went through the examples, there was no clear, easy way to transition these leases. I think the boards had decided we would just keep the existing balance as calculated under current GAAP and transition that forward on day one. And then under view A, if we were to grandfather IAS 17 and 840, that might be an easy way to transition these. It would provide the most relief to the current capital leases, but it would mean we'd have two completely different models outstanding for perhaps a very long time, depending on how long it takes these leases to run out. View B would say, okay, you would bring forward these balances, but then on day two, you would go to the new guidance. And I think there's some concerns about how would you transition to those new guidances, so that wasn't a clear, easy answer either.
But what is your recommendation?
I would recommend view C. VC would not provide as much relief to these leases, but it would ensure that all leases would be accounted for under the same model on a go-forward basis.
And I'll stop.
By the way, I think Danielle teed this up well. And by the way, Danielle, quite delicately in the paper, think the reason you see a paper without a recommendation is we felt that if we had different views amongst the staff, it wasn't necessarily helpful for you to.
Well, but that happened before.
Yes, I know. Yes, I know. But I think that Danielle's clearly given her reasons to say, why did you see, and obviously there is that benefit to say, all leases would be the same going forward. I think here we would, a staff would recommend view A, and maybe what I'd say is that the first question I'd almost say is, do the board think that it's worth providing relief for leases that are currently classified as finance leases? So, do you think that the accounting that we're proposing is kind of so similar to the accounting that's currently applied to finance leases that it makes sense to provide relief in this area? And I think if you decide that accounting is close enough and it does make sense to provide relief, then I think view A in the paper is the only one that really provides relief in a sense. Because it would at least say that for those leases classified as finance leases, you can just, effectively let your accounting run through. I think both views B and C in the paper don't really provide very much relief, obviously because view B would really only almost give you one day of relief. And it's almost like, well, what's the point? Let's just do fully retrospective. And I think view C actually potentially would be more onerous than doing a fully retrospective approach for lessors. And I think that view C is the modified approach that we've proposed for operating leases. And I think that it makes sense in the context of operating leases because if a lessee and lessor hasn't actually worked out a discount rate before and hasn't ever worked out a residual asset before, then that approach does provide some relief. Because, it gives you some relief on how you work out discount rate, how you work out residual asset. but I think it doesn't provide very much relief in the situation that it's already a finance lease and you've already, you know, worked out a discount rate and worked out the residual asset. So I suppose it's almost like saying if you decide you want to provide relief, then I think we would think that A is the one that really provides relief. If, however, you have concerns about, you know, prolonging a different accounting or you think those differences mean that you don't think you want to provide relief, then I'd almost say just requiring a fully retrospective approach for these leases might make more sense.
Whether the staff from both sides have different views on the difference between new model and the old model on financing lease, you just say, you know, the proposition is the difference is not significant. Therefore, it's not necessary to ask the people to read that.
Well, I think
whether the FSB staff and board members will have different views on the difference.
No, I think, and by the way, I'll start, and Daniel, please come in and add to it or correct it. I think we both have the same views on where there are differences, and maybe that's worth clarifying, because, you know, when is it different, when is it the same? So I think there's a few examples mentioned in places. I think previous finance lease accounting and what we're proposing will be virtually the same, almost identical, for any leases where there aren't residual value guarantees provided. So from a lessee's perspective, there'll be very, very little difference if there aren't residual value guarantees provided by the lessee. From the lessor's perspective, there would be a difference in that if we continue old accounting, a lessor would only recognise a receivable, whereas going forward, we'd ask them to break out a receivable and a residual. However, given these are finance leases, the amount of the residual should be pretty small. So I think that their breaking out the residual shouldn't make that much difference. However, there could be a difference where there are residual value guarantees included. And the reason is that under IS 17 today and under Topic 840, a lessee or lessor would include the maximum amount of a residual value guarantee, you know, in their numbers that they include for finance leases. Whereas under the proposals, a lessee would just include the estimated amount, which obviously could be lower. And from a lessor's perspective, if it's a residual value guarantee that doesn't sort of, where the guarantor isn't providing both up and downside sort of risk cover, then the guarantee wouldn't be part of the receivable. So what that would mean in a comparison, by the way, is that, again, the difference being that if you carried forward the old accounting, you'd get one receivable number. If you applied our proposals, you'd get a receivable and a residual number. I think the measurement on the lessor side wouldn't necessarily be very different. So, you know, if you added the receivable and the residual, it's broken out onto the proposals. That wouldn't necessarily be very different than if you just carried forward a full receivable. And the main reason I say that is I think that from previous conversations, we understand that the vast majority of residual value guarantees would be given around equipment leases, and it's usually a bank lessor that would be getting like a guarantee from a manufacturer. So in that case, there wouldn't be any sort of unearned profit piece, so the overall measurement should be reasonably close. So I don't know if there's Colin or Danielle, is there anything else to add?
Patricia?
Petrina, in reading Approach A, it sounds on the face of it horrible that we have to carry all this horrible literature, especially U.S. GAAP literature on leases, forward for many years. But I thought when we originally did this that's not what we intended, that more or less what we intended was that the balances at the date you adopt the new standard are your starting point for the new standard, and then you more or less followed the appropriate parts of the new standard, and you didn't have the ugly bits that are suggested in B. You don't have the day one. We don't go back. It's sort of like a deemed cost under IFRS 1. It's just where you start. You don't really. So the descriptions here didn't seem to gel with my understanding of what we thought we were doing.
I think that what you've just mentioned is probably a very sensible way to apply that if the board wants to go there. I think it is fair to say that we didn't, when it was talked about before, we didn't necessarily have the conversation to that level to say that's how we would make the board's decision work. But I think that what you suggest is a way that it, I think we thought about it as well, as a way that you could have view A be applied but without having to carry forward all the old guidance, that you could just from day two point into relevant paragraphs in the proposals.
But you know, when I voted for this, I thought what Pat explained is exactly the reason I voted for that proposal, because I thought you're taking the balances as of the transition date and apply with that those balances. All you're taking is the balances. You still have to know whether it's a type 1 or type 2 lease, and you need to do all that work. That's why I thought view A is what we intended with the balances to be taken and go forward. So I'm a little bit surprised that the pushback is no, that's not what we intended, to bring back the baggage and carry forward the baggage. I never voted that way. I'm sorry if I misunderstood it, because I remember distinctly, you take the number, you run with it.
No, because I think if you... you're still financing lease, I don't think we'll have two choice, you know, either go to type 1 or type 2, you know. Type 1 only, I'm right?
Yes.
Type 1 only. The only difference may be, you know, the residual value guarantee and other measurement side, you know, no classification.
Yeah, I think you're right, Wigu, in practice. I think, to be honest, PK, whether you made people under this, if we, you know, if we decided to provide relief, whether we would require people to go back and reclassify or not, you should virtually all the time get to type one anyway. So I would say if we're going with this, we should just tell people that they don't need to do any classification, and you just assume, you know, for presentation and disclosure purposes, you would just assume it's a type one lease.
Well, first, I think we started with the idea of bringing all leasing on balance sheet. We did not start with the idea of changing the current finance lease accounting. That was not the objective. We already would have forced people to restate a number of contracts you're pricing once and to bring them on the balance sheet. It's a heavy exercise. If we add to that changing the accounting, even moderately, but for all finance lease contracts, then it's a huge thing. So there was a cost to that exercise. There are possibly some benefits. Yes, maybe users are always better off if there is pure comparability. And as standard setters, we prefer pure comparability. Everything is the same, French garden, you know. But are those benefits really, given that the accounting is not that different, so great that we must force the cost of changing for everyone? I don't think so. But
page 4, right at the top. So for A, it says at least some, if not all, the existing guidance in IAS 17 will have to be carried forward. Is that true?
Well, I think that what we're saying, based on what Patricia and PK have said, and we agree with, is that we think we could do this without having to carry forward the guidance.
That's a great relief.
And because we could just point to relevant paragraphs.
Any more questions, comments? No,
I just had one question. At the top of 6B, you make the statement, because of the similarity between the accounting for current capital finance leases under the existing guidance and the proposed, you say there'd be little benefit from having to go through the new proposals. But so are you making an assertion based on just that theory, or based on some actual evidence that you wouldn't get a materially different outcome?
Well, I think we've thought through as many of the scenarios as we can think of, you know, and based on what we know are the, you know, the types of contracts that are written, Patrick, and at least from our perspective, we think that the only real area you get difference in accounting is
the one you described before.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's what I'm concerned about is how can you know whether or not that's going to be materially different or not? You're making, I guess, the jump that it wouldn't be, but I don't...
But I think we're making the jump that it wouldn't be because we thought about the accounting and the numbers. And
yeah, it's not self-evident to me. I don't know, maybe you can hum a few bars.
I mean, what do you want me to say? Because the discount rate, you know, the remaining lease payments are the remaining lease payments because the discount rate that's applied to them has already been calculated on an individual contract basis. And you know, from a lessee's perspective, you can use the incremental borrowing rate today. They would probably use the incremental borrowing rate going forward. Same for the lessor, they'd use mostly the rate implicit in the lease. That's what they used previously. Because, well, first of all, for finance leases, you don't really, I mean, first of all, we've changed the accounting around the measurement of options and variable lease payments to be almost the same, but you really don't get hardly any variable lease payments within finance leases.
Right.
So that shouldn't create a difference. If it's a finance lease, and there should be very few, you know, it won't really be a finance lease today with an unexercised option.
So coming back to PK's observation about being surprised with the FASB's conclusion, maybe Danielle can respond to this. I mean, why are they
okay, we resume our meeting and we're going to discuss insurance, starting with paper 2E. Isabella?
Hello, everyone. I would like to start with the paper 2E, which is discussing transition for contracts acquired through the business combination. This paper has two questions, and I would like to discuss them separately. First one is related to the measurement of those contracts at transition. And the second one is trying to answer the question how we should account for the transition adjustment, whether it should be accounted for in retained earnings or rather goodwill. So I would like to first discuss the measurement issue. And this issue is described in the paper in paragraph 4 to 13. The staff recommended that the insurer should apply the same transition requirement for contracts acquired through the business combination as you have decided for the contracts written by the insurer. This would mean that the insurer would apply the standards retrospectively. When the retrospective application is impracticable, the insurer would estimate residual margin and discount rate at inception by maximizing the use of objective information available with some simplification. When the insurer will apply those transition requirements for contracts acquired through the business combination, the insurer would need to remember that for those contracts, the date of inception is the date of the business combination. And one of the cash flows is the fair value of those contracts at the business combination. The staff believes that this requirement would be consistent with how we have decided to measure and account for the contracts acquired through the business combination in the standard. And this is explained in paragraphs 6 and 7 of the agenda paper. So now I would like to ask you if you have any questions and whether you agree with this staff recommendation.
Silence means agreement?
Right after lunch.
Silence means agreement.
Such a clear paper.
Thank you very much. That was easy. Once we know how to measure insurance contracts at transition date, the question remains, where would we like to account the difference, the transition difference? Some people believe that this transition adjustment should be made against goodwill, and this view is described in paragraph 16 of the agenda paper. However, the staff believe that insurers should adjust retained earnings rather than goodwill, because other standards don't require adjustment of goodwill, even if retrospective application of the standard was required as transition. Therefore, the staff believe that it would create an exception, and the staff believe it's not justifiable. Other reasons for the recommendation are included in paragraph 15 of the agenda. And now I would like to ask you again whether you have any questions or whether you agree with the staff recommendation.
Agreed.
I agree.
Okay. Oh, one question.
I agree. but I want to ask a question here because I don't become too detailed in the question, but I want to ask a question here. When you take the cash flows at the date of the acquisition, which is at the fair value on that day, that means theoretically on the date of the fair value, you have done two or three things. You have done the cash flows, you have done the risk adjustment, and you have done the probably residual margin also in that cash flows on the date of acquisition. I agree that perhaps somebody can say the risk adjustment on that day inherent in that includes not just the entity specific but a fair value, true fair value. But I, logically speaking, I don't see any difference between the risk adjustment at fair value and the risk adjustment which is entity specific. I don't see it. 4 years being on the board, I didn't see any difference between those two. Question for you. When you take the risk adjustment on the date of transition backwards, that might have a diversification benefit which is unrelated to that acquisition. So you will be unnecessarily forcing a difference between the risk adjustment that you are taking at the date of transition back to the acquisition and the acquisition date risk adjustment which is calculated at fair value. Why would you want to use the diversification benefit, which is unrelated to that acquisition, which applies to all transition issues, not just for this,
yeah,
to that. Why would you want to do that? Don't you think the risk adjustment on the date of acquisition should be the risk adjustment rather than using artificial factors which came into play subsequently into that effect? I think we should think about that. I don't think we should carte blanche say, use the risk adjustment on the date of transition and move it backwards. You guys get the point?
I think what you're saying, PK, is you're disagreeing with the decision that was taken last month, in effect, no?
In the sense that what I'm saying is that taking the risk adjustment, other than the points that we discussed, the diversification benefits that
different.
Have, suppose I had only life business and I have an annuity business subsequently, there is a diversification benefit which we said can be attributed to everyone.
Yeah.
You're moving back to the things that, especially in the business combination, it really pops out very apparent for me.
I think it comes down to the discussion that we had last month about when you can do it retrospectively, you do it retrospectively anyway, and then you would have the right diversification benefit and the right risk adjustment. When you can't, we were trying to balance a sort of objective measure of the residual margin, which means that we're accepting imperfections in the measurement of the risk adjustment, known imperfections. And last month we talked about overstating or understating the residual margin, depending on which route you did. To effectively assess the diversification benefits for a contract when you've already concluded that transition can't be applied retrospectively is quite a big ask. And I think that's probably why we are where we are.
But would you not think that if you have done fair value on the date of acquisition, would you not just use those and see what is the residual margin rather than applying the risk adjustment on the date of acquisition backwards, on the date of transition backwards and things like that?
Again, it comes down to your principle. If you have the fair value and the data at that date and you can do it retrospectively and it's objective, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that is very clear for me in this paper. I just have to tell you that I thought you have to take the fair value, you have to compare this with that, and then come up with the residual margin. You're saying you don't need to do that.
No. Well, if it's practicable,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Retrospective application is practicable. You do have the objective data. You would use the data you have.
I don't think it's very clear for me here.
I think that's probably a point that we would need to make clear for all of them, because this situation applies broader than just business combination.
It is more apparent in this case because I have a risk adjustment, but I have done it in a fair value context.
Right, okay.
One additional point I would like you to clarify. If the adoption of the standard takes place in the 12 months following a business combination date, given that we have a 12 months remeasurement period for business combinations for assets acquired, why would not you remeasure the assets and liabilities acquired on the basis of the new standard within that period of 12 months subsequent to a business combination? If no, I think you need to have a discussion of why not.
Felipe, is that really to the second point about adjusting goodwill or not?
Yes. But it seems to me that it's not a new event that triggers an evaluation, but it's a new way to approach the evaluation of the assets and liabilities as of the date of acquisition. And usually we have 12 months to remeasure, to correct errors, whatever. And here we say no, never adjust goodwill, never. And I wonder whether in the 12 months there is a basis for adjusting the goodwill. I put it on the table as a discussion of the point in the paper. I think that is worth having a look at and whatever decision we make to explain.
I think you're correct. That's an IFRS 3 requirement that's discussed in Appendix A2. And this is a requirement that when you know there are known errors and facts and circumstances, a new standard is not an economic event. So if new facts and circumstances do occur, it does so happen to occur when you're transitioning, I think the IFRS 3 requirements would apply.
I agree it's not an error per se.
Yeah.
It's just that the fair value of the assets on the date of the acquisition, really for insurance contracts acquired on a business combination, I don't think people do a fair value accounting exercise. There is no market value. So they do approach the value based on some assessment of the economic value. And here we have a different way to look at the economic value of the contracts with a new approach. So it's a different measurement. And so I'm not sure really whether we can say don't apply the IFRS 3 rules in this case. So at least we need to explain why.
I think they would apply the IFRS 3 rules. It was not our intention to create an exception to the IFRS 3 rules that you're talking about.
If you apply IFRS, then you adjust goodwill normally.
No, this is the only circumstance where you do adjust goodwill, the IFRS 3 situation.
Yes, very true. She's right.
That needs to be explained.
I think you've raised a good point. I think in the drafting, we do have to make that clear that this IFRS 3 requirement still applies.
Well, that it applies, but the view is that an adjustment arising from the application of a new standard is not the kind of adjustment that is contemplated
exactly.
In that
Even with retrospective application.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, clarifications will be made. That concludes the discussion on this paper, and we can proceed with paper 2A.
Thank you. We would now like to turn to agenda paper 2A.
Yes, and Andrea.
We note that the ISB has now concluded its planned technical discussions in the insurance contract project. Although sweep issues may arise during the drafting process, the staff believe that the IASB's redeliberations are substantially complete. As a result, the staff would like to request permission from the IASB to ballot a targeted, revised exposure draft. The staff has prepared a package of materials to facilitate the IASB's decision. This package includes the appendices to Agenda Paper 2A. In addition, the staff presented the IASB with an overview of the proposed model in Agenda Paper 2B at yesterday's education session. The staff also presented Agenda Papers 2C and 2D, which together illustrate the ways in which the IASB has addressed the comments of respondents on the 2010 exposure draft. On the basis of the IASB's previous decision to publish a targeted revised exposure draft,
the finalization of the technical decisions in this project, and the ISB's demonstrated compliance with due process requirements, the staff requests the ISB's permission to begin the balloting process. Does the ISB have any questions for the staff?
Well, I would like to congratulate the staff on the quality of the papers and the clear insight it provides and everything that we have decided thus far. Comment letters. I think we have all the information needed to come to a conclusion.
Yeah.
So, do we indeed want to grant the staff permission to be in the balloting process?
Just a tiny question. Are we quite sure which questions we will ask in the invitation to comment? Are we definitely ring fenced exactly the extent of the questions, or is that part of the decision making? I mean, I don't object at all to giving permission. I just don't remember exactly which questions we are focusing on in the invitation to comment. Can you remind us briefly what are those questions?
Yes, absolutely. And the invitation to comment will be part of the balloting package for the board members to see. But the five areas that are going to be re-exposed are the treatment of unearned profit in the contract, the treatment of participating contracts, presentation in the statement of comprehensive income, especially regarding insurance contract revenue, the use of other comprehensive income to present changes in the liability arising from changes in the discount rate, and transition.
In this question on OCI, are we asking specifically whether it should be mandatory or an option to use OCI?
I believe that is going to be addressed in the question.
When we're drafting the basis for conclusions and as we're setting up the invitation to comment, and bear in mind we're still drafting that at the moment, we are exploring the possibility of a mandatory versus optional use of other comprehensive income, as well as other matters that were raised in the papers and, you know, which affected your decisions. We're setting out the questions at a reasonably high level on those main topics. But we think that the discussion we have in the basis of conclusion should get the right sort of input on, give us the opportunities to get input on all of these questions. In addition to the questions that Andrea mentioned, we are asking an overall question on the operational complexity of the standard and also on the reporting complexity that's generated by the standard. And we're also asking a question on the clarity of drafting. So in effect, we're treating the rest of the exposure draft, which is not part of these five targeted areas, almost like a review draft.
Good.
All in favor?
Yes.
Yes.
Next, the staff would like to ask the ISB if any board members intend to dissent from the publication of the targeted revised exposure draft.
Yum.
I'd like to give a few comments on that question. I dissented to the exposure draft we did 2010. Mm-hmm. There basically three major objections. Paid off well, board listened. Locked in margin has changed. Presentation has become what I asked for. Risk margin remains, and we have added two new complications. We have added this change of discount rate going to OCI, and we have financial instruments fair value through OCI possibly coming. I am afraid that the presentation we will do now will not be well received by a lot of people. I think we will get more assistance than what we expect. But I've still decided not to dissent, because I think this has gone so long. It was more than 5 years ago when almost everyone on the discussion paper answered that we need an urgent standard. So I will live with my inconsequent action, but I will not dissent.
Thank you.
Ian?
Well, I voted for the 2010 exposure draft, but I intend to dissent from this one. And you all know the reason, which is the OCI decision. I don't believe that is conducive to good financial reporting in this particular case, and the way we've structured it, I think it's taking us backwards, so that'll be the reason.
Thank you. Finally, the staff would like to recommend a comment period of 120 days for the targeted revised exposure draft, we believe that this period of time would provide stakeholders with sufficient time to assess the implications of the IISB's proposal. Does the IISB have any questions for the staff?
All agree with 120 days.
Can you just give us a timeline? Can you just give us a timeline of how you plan? I agree with 120 days, but just give us a timeline, like, you know, we expect exposure draft, not in the second quarter, like loose terms, but a little bit more clarity than a little bit more clarity, just to understand when is this going to end? And 2012, 2013, 2014, like that.
And 2012 is too late.
We'd like to go back in time, but that's not an option. We would like to finish both analyzing the comments and the roundtables and other forms of outreach in the fieldwork plan before the end of 2013. So hopefully we would be back at the board table to present a comprehensive summary of the feedback received before the end of the year.
Now, the related question, do we know where FASB is on this? Because are we overlapping any documents with them? Oh, yeah, sorry, Jennifer.
The FASB is here.
Are we overlapping? That's what I wanted to ask.
Jennifer?
Yes, good morning or good afternoon.
Morning.
Yeah, so we intend on issuing our documents also, you know, essentially in June of this year. We did vote last week, or the board voted last week, for a 120-day comment letter period to allow companies to do some field testing. So our document's obviously going out a little bit later than your document. We were allowing a 120-day comment letter period, but we're around the same timeline with trying to then get all the comments back in and absorb them. So it's just, I think there's going to be a little bit of a time difference just between when we're issuing the documents, potentially.
Jennifer, I have a simple question. Is a comprehensive EDO some kind of a amendment to the current standards?
So it will be an overall exposure draft. We will be highlighting where the differences are. You know, as we've said in the past, and there's some, you know, people can go either way. Some people can say it's a complete rewrite. Other people look at this and say, you know, I can identify the 10 areas that we're essentially changing. So we'll link those, but it will be an exposure draft overall of the whole standard.
Amaro?
Thanks. Is it appropriate to ask about outreach plans at this stage, or?
You can ask. We are still developing our outreach plans. We are planning a fairly comprehensive program at the moment, targeted obviously on areas, people, issues in areas that we know are going to be issues, and also trying to reach out to places that we haven't heard from before. Because I think the project's been very well followed by some interested parties, but we're also aware that it's been a long project to follow, and it's a fairly complicated one to follow the deliberations as they're going through. So we're keen to make sure that people who've been affected by this understand the implications, even if they haven't been able to follow the project so closely.
And I find, thank you about that. And I find that particularly important because when you describe in one of the papers about what we've done, we've covered Europe, the U.S., Asia, Oceania, but Latin America in general has been missed in previous outreach. So I would suggest to consider as part of this. And another question is, since there's some overlap with the expected overlap with the exposure draft, FASB's exposure draft, do we have any plans to conduct any joint outreach on that? Because I guess in North America, let's say, if we do have an interest in the U.S. and the models are different, then we are going to do a field test with two models, we might not achieve really good feedback.
I'm not sure if we've made a difference.
I think we're still formalizing our outreach plans. We are aware, of course, that if we're going out with different exposure drafts, then it can be confusing to people to try and comment on two different things simultaneously. At the same time, what we're trying to achieve with our outreach is input that will help us refine the exposure draft that we're going to publish and to develop that exposure draft into an IFRS. So that needs to come into consideration as well.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you. This concludes this part of the meeting. We can only start again at 2:45 because we will be joined by the testing staff. We'll start discussing revenue recognition.
Okay.